I want to talk to you about TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off manufactured suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One game could run this city. One game. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast this week. Very funny comedian friend of mine, New York-based comedian Mike Kaplan. Mike's got a really interesting background. We're going to talk about his life as a graduate student and then how he got into comedy, his music background, his parents. We'll get into it all. It's like a therapy session, but not. Actually, just really fun. Cool conversation with Mike. Having a great time. I'm right now at the Cleveland Improv. Really cool venue. Having a great time. Check out pictures from it on my site, at my Facebook page as well, and on Twitter, Instagram, Paul Mercurio. Really cool time here. People are coming out in droves, having a blast with folks. And unfortunately, the Cleveland Indians aren't playing, so I can't get to see baseball. But having a great time. And check me out doing stand-up coming up. My tour dates this coming week, I will be in Los Angeles at the Hollywood Melrose Improv, Comedy Factory, Largo. I'll be all over the place. And then the following week, I am in Cap City's Comedy Club in Austin, Texas, October 29th and November 1st. And after that, Comics Comedy Club at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. Then I go to Omaha. Then I'm in Columbus, Ohio at the Funny Bone there. The Omaha Funny Bone, the Columbus Funny Bone, the Denver Improv, and Washington, D.C. Improv right up until the end of the year. So lots of tour dates. Go to my site to check them out. And thanks for checking out the podcast and spread it around, people.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
All right, joining me this week on the podcast, a very funny comedian, a friend of mine, both live in New York City, Mike Kaplan. Welcome, Mike. How you doing, hey, buddy?
Great, thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody from New York City.
Mike's been seen on The Tonight Show, Last Comic Standing, Conan, Comedy Central Presents, and has a podcast of his own. Where can people hear your podcast, just so we get them tuned into that?
Sure thing. It's called Hang Out With Me, and it's on the Keith and the Girl Network, so it's at keithandthegirl.com/hang, or you can get to it through my own website, mikekaplan.com.
And also he has a Netflix special out, which you guys should definitely check out. And Mike has a very unique background, has a master's degree. What kind of a graduate degree, but mine's in law, so there's not a lot. I don't know if there's a lot of us that have postgraduate degrees, but did you plan on sort of another career and then this kind of took off?
No, I wasn't planning on really any career. And in fact, at this point, you know, certainly you don't need any degrees to do comedy. Right. I didn't waste a ton of money. Like I sort of, for undergrad, I had a lot of, sort of scholarships and things. And I went to a school that gave me those specifically so that I wouldn't end up in a ton of debt. But
yeah,
I went to Brandeis.
Did you go to Brandeis?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then did you what was your major undergrad?
Philosophy and psychology, and then I also got a minor in math and linguistics, and then linguistics is what I went to grad school for at Boston University, where basically I just didn't want to go into the real world. I didn't know what real job I would want, so I kept going to schooling, and I lived as a resident assistant, so I didn't have like any rent to pay, and it was just much cheaper to live. And then I got, you know, sort of a job in a cafe, and then I got a linguistics related job at a technology company. And then I started doing comedy around then when I was in grad school, and that became the goal. And I was like, well, if I can eventually, you know, I would have been happy to just keep doing, I guess if comedy didn't work out, I would probably still be, you know, I'd probably be in my like 14th year of grad school now, but I became,
what prompted you to decide to start doing stand-up? I mean, I know you have a music background and your parents are musicians, and you played, like, I find a lot of comedians sort of have a musical background. Did you start with music as sort of the possible thing that you were going to actually step into and then decide, and then it just sort of took off from there into comedy, or what was
that? That is pretty much exactly right. I mean, I was made to play the violin when I was 4 because it was like sort of like more important than religion to my mother. I feel like it was music. Really? Was her life, and she wanted, the same way that I think a lot of people are like, I don't care what my kid does as long as they, you know, believe what I believe or do this thing, or, you know, this is the important thing to me. Right. And for her, like, she gave me the opportunity to decide whether or not I wanted to go to, like, Hebrew school, Sunday school, you know, learn about, she wanted me to have that too, but not as much as, like, I probably, if I threw a fit, I probably could have stopped going to temple and not had a bar mitzvah, but I threw tons of fits and was never allowed to stop playing the violin. So,
was that her instrument? And did she have a lifelong goal, a passion of being? She a professional musician?
She was a professional musician, not a violinist. She played like the French horn, baritone horn, trombone. Those were like the main things. She's now a piano teacher. She plays a lot of things, she went to school for music. She performed in like marching bands down at the Jersey Shore. She performed in like symphony orchestras. And she was, her main job throughout most of my life was a music teacher. Like, she taught elementary school music, among other things. But
I would think a marching band at the Jersey Shore would get pelted by garbage with all the Jersey Shore Guidos. And I could say that because I'm Italian and I know what those guys are. I would just think like it would be a challenging endeavor down at the Jersey Shore to be in a marching band. You know,
that sounds totally like right now. Yeah. I think we have this idea that, you know, the people who live at the Jersey Shore are these like, you know, big dumb jocks, and that the marching band is just a bunch of nerds. But I feel like after high school, there must be some differentiation where, as adults, don't do that to each other, or maybe this was a different time in the past of the Jersey Shore where it wasn't, you know, it was pre what it is now. But that's a great question. I'll ask my mom if there were.
No, I'm not saying your mom's a nerd or anything. I just when you see that the shows like the Jersey Shore, and they continue in different iterations to this day, sort of, I have a problem with it because it's, you know, they think all Italians are like that, you know, it's sort of a stereotypes us in a bad way, but that's interesting that your dad was also a musician as well. And
they met in music school at NYU, I think, and he got out of it at a certain point. Like, he was a high school marching band director and also, but then he eventually started teaching sort of like more technology classes, computers and stuff, and now enjoys music, but it was never like the gotta have it thing exactly always, or maybe it was, but it isn't now. Like, he sort of, my parents got divorced when I was in high school and, you know, then went their separate ways, both, you know, physically, emotionally, and I guess musically, professionally as well. So
was that hard for you in high school to see them get divorced, or did you see it coming?
You know, I didn't see it coming. Like, when I feel like I now thinking about it, I've never really framed it in these terms, but I guess I was fairly, like, I've always been pretty optimistic, even when there were adverse circumstances, kind of like Zen Buddhist-like, where, you know, sort of rolling with it, you know, just being very yin and be like, whatever happens. Like, when I remember being a kid and my parents were together, I remember thinking like, oh, wow, this is really good. This is happy. Like, some of my friends might have had parents that were divorced or getting divorced. And I was like, oh, man, that doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Like, I definitely remember thinking like, we're happy. They're happy. They'll never get divorced. That'll be great. But then when I was like 12, 13, 14, whenever the problems began and happened, I don't know, it was sort of over that several year period where they, you know, they told me they were going to get divorced, and they told me they were going to counseling. Then, you know, they were trying to work things out. And But then eventually deciding that they, you know, they're like, it's the best thing for us is to not be together. And I was like, well, I wasn't like, no, you got, like, I was like, yeah. Well, that sounds like the right, I thought, you know, by this point in my life, I remember they told me like the sort of the tropes of that you tell a kid, like, oh, it's not your fault. We both love you. And I was like, yeah, of course. I know that. What am I, an idiot? Like, right. I didn't do anything.
Did anybody in the room imply that it was my fault? Like, yeah, when somebody says that, then you're starting to go, well, maybe you are saying it's my fault. Cause I never, it was like, I don't have a zit on my face. Why are you saying I have a zit on my face? Yeah. It's that kind of thing. Right?
I didn't even get to that level of like paranoia or, you know, meta analysis. I was just like, hey, of course, not my fault. Go for it. Do what makes you happy. If you're not happy together, be happy apart. And I mean, I guess what was rougher on me actually was just we had moved. And so like I, after seventh grade, now was with a bunch of new kids that I didn't grow up with. I didn't know, I wasn't like super socialized with them or didn't really know how to be, like how to meet people. Cause as a kid, you meet people first, and then if you move, you're like, oh, I've never done this before. And I was definitely a nerd, you know, like gigantic glasses and braces and slick down hair that my grandfather combed or not at all combed, and I didn't care. And like, you know,
I think we were all nerds. Like, we just didn't know. You know, my parents made me do stuff, and it was nerdy. Like, I think everybody's got their version of nerddom at some point in their childhood, I think, anyway, you know?
Oh, sure. I mean, and I don't care. Like, I kind of like the word dork better than nerd, if I'm going to pick, but...
what is the difference? Is there a difference?
I don't think a dork has to be smart, you know, about anything in particular. Like, you can just like... I mean, the words are now... I mean, when I studied linguistics, obviously, that's sort of the whole thing is, like, learning that language is a, you know, a diverse and changing thing. Like, even in English, even in the same dialect of English, like, you might, if I said to you, what is a nerd and what is a dork and what is the difference, you might have a different line between them, or you might have one as a subcategory of one, or they might be an overlap, or maybe some people think they're synonyms, like, people will use them exactly the same. And so, to me, I feel like the classic sort of paradigm of the prototype of a nerd is good in school. And a dork doesn't have to be good in school. Like, whereas a dork just has to, like, say, like dorky things, let's say. You know, like, you could be a Star Trek dork and an idiot. Maybe. Right. I mean, maybe there was an overlap where, like, some of the kids who were smart also... You could be often a nerd and a dork.
Well, if you were a linguistics dork, you would be able to speak Klingon, correct? Is that...
That sounds great. Absolutely, yeah. The linguistics, they would call it. And so
if you were going to do linguistics, would you have, by the way, there's a really great PBS special that Robin Lear did. He used to report about the history of language in the world. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I'm assuming you could find it sort of on Netflix or whatever, but you should check it out if you were in linguistics
Sure.
person of any. Yeah, it's a really interesting series that he did. But did you contemplate sort of anything in the field of linguistics at all, like sort of being a teacher, interpreter? Like, was there anything that all that struck you as possibly going into, or you were just literally biding your time in grad school?
I knew that, you know, I was sort of optimistic that I would be able to forge some sort of, you know, cobble together some kind of career in performing, even if it meant that I just had to keep working at this cafe, doing this linguistics job, but then going out at night and performing at, you know, open mics or booked shows or whatever it was, whether it was comedy or music, which it was first, because I guess the piece that's missing is what I eventually did teach myself guitar in high school. Mm-hmm. And then I loved it. I hated playing the violin. I loved playing the guitar because the violin I had to, but the guitar I was choosing to, and then I was happy that I had all these music theory lessons in my past and that I knew how to, like, I could pick it up so much easier from having played the violin for so many years that then I started writing songs, and then some of the songs were funny, and I would play them, you know, at my summer camp, at talent shows, at college, in coffee houses, like, go out into Boston where I was in school, like, to open mic nights, too, and eventually... found a comedy club that was the Comedy Studio in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And yeah, the one above the
Chinese restaurant. Yeah, above the Hong Kong. They're still there. Yeah, I still go back there, and it's they now do shows like Tuesday through Sunday, you know, every day but Monday. And at the time, I think it was just like Thursday to Sunday. And so it was like probably the first night I performed, there was not a Friday or Saturday. It was like a Thursday or a Sunday. They said, you could have 5 minutes or 7 minutes. And I think the people on the show who I didn't realize at the time, like Jonathan Katz was on the show, and he had a cartoon on Comedy Central. I was like, oh my God, he's a famous person and he's going on right before me. And like Louis C.K. was also on the show, which I didn't even realize or find out until many years later when like a program from that night resurfaced. And I was like, oh wow. And like Andy Blitz, who was like a writer for Conan and has written for a lot of other things. And that, like, it was just a super amazing show and me. And I remember just really starting to enjoy performing at comedy clubs, and I would play two songs and I would talk in between the songs. And then little by little, I was like, I really like this talking. And so I sort of would talk and then do one song. And eventually I was like, I would rather not carry this guitar around at all. And and then in the meantime, I'm in grad school, and I am definitely drawing out grad school so that I can keep, having this free housing and pursue this goal at night, this dream, which was sort of an ideal situation. Like, if I could recommend to people who are like, how do I start doing comedy? What's the hardest thing? One of the hardest things is like putting in enough time, but also, you know, you're not a professional when you start, so you probably have another job unless you're independently wealthy. But then switching from having a job not in comedy to then, you know, getting rid of that job completely, like my job was fortunately very flexible because I was originally doing it like 20 hours a week. Then little by little, I dropped down to 15 and 10, and they were cool with it until eventually I didn't need that job at all. And that's when I was like, well, I guess I'm done with grad school and I'm a comedian now. And I mean, at any point in the game, I'm aware that next year I could make, you know, half the money I made this year or a third of it or a quarter, like you never know. And that's a thing that scares some people about like this, you know, the artistic non-conventional 9-to-5 lifestyle, which isn't necessarily as secure as people have thought, you know, 50 years ago. Anyway, so I say, you know, if you have a dream, go for it. And like, because nothing is guaranteed, but, I have some savings in the bank, but yeah, of course, if I have to, I'll get a job at a cafe again.
Sort of balance business and commerce, you know, but business and, commerce and art rather, because, you know, sort of, you want to sort of be able to play to the masses so you can eat and get bookings and all of that. But you also want to sort of, you know, I think all of us as comics, you know, or in any artistic endeavor want to sort of sometimes just go down a road that, you know, is not going to necessarily be popular with the masses, but is creatively fulfilling. And like, so how do you sort of balance those two things, if at all? Like, is that anything that sort of ever comes into play for you?
I focus much more on the, you know, creative side of things than the business side of things. Like, I'm sure that there's some things that I naturally do. You know, I think we all have our strengths and our weaknesses. And I think there's some viewing, you know, being good at business as, you know, oh, if you're good at that, then maybe you're not as good at the other thing. Like, there's certainly, I think we've all seen some people successful, more successful, like, objectively, than other people who we think, well, that person is an artist. Why aren't they as successful? Maybe because they didn't email as many people, right? Which doesn't mean, you know, doesn't mean anything necessarily good or bad about either of the people's methods. Like, everybody should do what they're good at or what they want to do or strive to get better at the things that they're not. But I think that, like, so on a micro level, like, when I'm, like, writing new material and performing new material, like, I have some clubs that I go to in the city or some like smaller rooms where I'm getting paid very little or not at all, where I don't care at all what the reaction is. Like, I'm not there to, not that I'm not there to entertain the people. I'm like, I hope that these things are great, but you have to work out your new stuff somewhere. So I might have a 20-minute set that's half full of, you know, not untried stuff that hopefully will be an amazing night that they're like, oh my God, we saw it succeed here first. But sometimes you'll have half of the set full of, if not silence. Like, I've gotten better over the years at, you know, couching failures in funny ways that people are like, oh man, wasn't it funny that didn't work? Oh, we're having a great time seeing these jokes fail. But so that's the way that I feel like I grow creatively, or at least I, you know, grow material, is to have some places compartmentalized where I don't care if it fails. Like, you can't fear rejection, ever as a comedian.
You mean you have some specific rooms, clubs that you can go to where you can fail and it's not a big deal, is what you're saying?
Yes, that, and also, I mean, even like when I'm headlining on the road, like at some clubs, it's like I didn't used to riff a lot on stage, and now when an audience is good, I will, and that's where, obviously I do, I have a lot of bits that are, you know, pre-written, and I work on them off stage, but then I allow myself, about halfway into my, you know, I've been doing comedy about 12 years. And so around 2000, started around 2002, and then around 2006, 7-ish, I met Rory Scovel, who like improvises on stage so much, and that was inspiring to see. And a good buddy of mine, Micah Sherman, who is now an amazing improviser and has been, but was doing stand-up as well at the time, was just always so in the moment. And I was like, that's impressive. I'm like, you can, I kind of didn't know that you could do that. Like, I knew crowd work was a thing, but I thought it wasn't my thing. But I stopped having the preconceived notion of the kind of person that I was. And I'm like, oh, if I do that thing, then I can be that thing. I can be a different thing than I am. And that allowed me to grow both, I think, as a human, as a comedian, as a performer. And so now some, like, if I have an amazing, like, I go to Acme. I've gone to Acme, like, I think the past 3 years. And it's, like, one of my favorite clubs that I've ever been at. I recorded one of my albums there. And just every show, I feel like, I would say some things that I'd never said before, and then I'd listen back and be like, oh, that's an amazing, that's great, I'll add, that's now part of the bit. And then, right. You know, it grows like, starts like a snowflake, and then you roll it down the hill, and eventually it's a giant snowball, and it's an avalanche, and you have a whole new 5 minutes where I used to just have one line. And so in that situation, like, when the audience is up for it, I don't feel like it is even, it's not even as much a risk, because sometimes the audience wants you to take risks. Sometimes, like, if you go to the UCB, like Whiplash, Monday nights in New York City, that's a free show that gets so many great comedians and then so many great audiences, and it's a nice positive feedback loop where you can just, not that you can do anything, like, you know, you can't just take a crap on everybody, I mean, but sometimes people do, or like, there's people there who, you know, to see like Ted Alexander there, Colin Quinn there, like those guys working out like brand new things or just being completely in the moment. And sometimes, you know, so there's a time and a place for those things, but then there's certainly times and places where I'm like, oh, I'm doing a corporate gig. I'm getting paid. I can't just make things up on the spot because that's not what I've been hired to do here. So yeah, certainly there are gigs for which, if not the more money you're being paid, like, but the more specifically serious the situation is, then I will be like, well, here are the jokes that I know work for this situation.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about, there's a quote and something that you said, that when you introduce a joke into the world, particularly a new joke, the audience laughs. It's the most invigorating, thrilling thing. Did that sort of hit you when you were sort of transitioning like away from, because that kind of was what happened to me. I was writing jokes. I sold some jokes to some people, and they did them like on national TV, and that blew me away. And then I started doing it myself, and then I started getting the laughs. Did you have that sort of epiphany moment, like where that reaction came to you, and you were like, this feels like the right place for me to be?
I don't know if I can point to a specific moment, but I definitely, you know, there's certainly a spectrum, sort of an arc, like of the narrative of the, you know, the growth of, I feel like there's sort of these ups and downs too, where, you know, sometimes you do your first show and it's amazing, and then you do your second show and it's the worst, and then they're all the worst and it's the worst, and you're like, in the beginning, like, you can't even, you know, you don't worry about whether it's good or bad or right, like, you know, you're like, I feel like I know what I'm doing, like, you feel like you know what you're doing before you actually know, you know, 2 years later.
Yeah,
like,
you don't have the presence. Yeah. I mean, you've also said that no joke is ever finished, which I've said as well, and does that frustrate you at times, or do you like that sort of open-endedness of it?
You know, I don't think of it as frustrating, the thing that can be, if not frustrating, is like, I have in my Netflix special, there's a joke that you know, I recorded because I'm like, oh, this is basically, the thing about recording a special or an album is, the interesting thing is like, some of the jokes will have been created 4 years ago, and you're like, okay, this has been honed and polished and it's ready to go. And, you know, there's a lot more growth and change in a joke in the first weeks or months of its existence than a year later necessarily. If you're like, oh, this is how it goes, maybe you'll find something new. Maybe you'll find a new avenue or a new wording. But it's sort of, you know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever done glass blowing, but I went to a summer camp where there was glass blowing. And like, when the glass is like in the furnace, it's like, it's liquid. It's like, you know, it's rolling around, you get it on the pipe, you get it out of the furnace, and then it cools down so quickly that, you know, you can still like chip away at it eventually, but it, you know, it melds into place. And a joke is like that, or it can be. I'd say most jokes start off liquid, really liquidy, and you're figuring out, oh, what shape, is this going to be a plate? Is it going to be a bowl? Is it going to be a statue of a penguin? Like, it could be anything. You could make it into any shape, but eventually when it cools, you're like, okay, well, now I can heat it up again, but it's still, you know, I can heat it up completely and get rid of it and make it now a different joke. And now the analogy is sort of disappearing, like, back into the flames. But I would say, so this joke that existed in my special about the TSA and going through security, like, it was mostly done. It was in its final shape. And then, like, a month later, after it was recorded, I came up with, like, another line that I was like, oh, no, this, I would love for this joke to be in there. But at that point, it was, quote-unquote, too late. Like, the special is recorded. I can't go back. I thought about if it was going to be a DVD having, like, bonus features, like, the rest of, you know, this joke now. Like, the way that Hedberg, on his second album, put a joke that was on his first album because he wrote a new line for it, and he's like, I can't rob you of this. Like, and that was really funny. But most people won't do that. Most people are like, well, which I like the idea of, I have a friend who's a rapper, and we've started like doing freestyle rapping together sometimes. And one of the main tenets of that is, if your buddy's rapping and you think of something to say in that moment, but he's still rapping and then it's gone, you have to let it go. And then you have to just be in the moment and respond to what's happening there. So having that attitude with respect to comedy, with respect to, you know, so many things like opportunities, be like, oh, if the moment passed, if the opportunity is gone, let it go and be okay with that. And because you're still alive, you're still moving forward. Even, I mean, when life is gone, let that go. You won't even exist to be letting it go. But just being as present as possible. So that's why it doesn't frustrate me. Like, obviously, if I had thought of it a month earlier, I would have been like, oh, wow. Well, now my special has one extra joke in it. But nobody's watching the special being like, oh, man, why didn't he say centaur?
Right, you know? Exactly. He missed a complete... It's so obvious. It's like the hand in front of your face. Like, yeah, that, you're right. It's sort of, you know, it's not there. But do you talk about being in the moment... And I think that's hard when you're starting to do stand-up because frankly, I don't know, I think most of us, I don't know if it's the case with you, you're just kind of frightened initially when you're up there and you just want to get, you know, you're just getting your legs underneath you, and it takes a while to be comfortable kind of just being naked up there, as they say, in front of strangers. But do you now let yourself, it sounds like you let yourself be in the moment more. Does that, and what form does that take? Like, will you interact with the audience and play with them a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
And that's sort of like, some people call it crowd work, but...
I would definitely, in my mind, crowd work has a more specific, if, you know, it doesn't have to have this format, but like, I don't always, when I riff, I don't usually, sometimes I'll have conversations with the audience, which then, yes, I would say that is crowd work, but I'll have more specific, like, I don't like to just ask people, you know, like, I'll have specific questions that are a part of some specific bit, like I have a... talking about whether I want children and talking about the comparison of talking to an adult and how they are and what they want and what their desires are compared to a child. So I have a bit about asking a child how old they wish they were. So I'll ask an adult in the audience how old they are and how old they wish they were, and then compare and contrast. So it's not that necessarily in that moment comedy.
Well, you use that to get into the bit is what you do. You use that as a way to get into the bit. But will you engage people just because in the moment something strikes you, the person's sitting, and then you just let yourself go into a conversation, not knowing where it's going to go, and not necessarily maybe even having a bit that's tied to it, just a sort of a...
Definitely. I mean, and sometimes even in planned bits, like in this situation, one time a kid who was 19 said that he wished that he would be 50. And I was like, oh, that is I'm not going to just go on with my comedy like by rote, because I've never heard a 19-year-old wish he was 50. Let's delve into this. Why did you say that? What does that mean? Let me ask. And he was like, you know, because I want to be wise. I'm like, well, that's the wisest thing I've ever heard anybody say. You're already there. You don't even have to be. I can't even imagine what you're going to be like when you're 50. You better die sooner. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only thing that I would say no to in what you asked is I don't look at... I'm a much more audio person than visual. Not that I'm not looking at people, but I know a lot of comedians will like either make eye contact with, you know, either every member of the audience that they can see, or somebody for one joke and somebody for another joke. But I am mostly not connecting with people on a visual level, but mostly just on an audio level. So I'm more likely to respond to a sound. Like if it's, you know, if either I hear somebody too loudly say something, or if I can tell it's not them asking for the, you know, a drink from the waitress or a waiter, if I, but if somebody responds to something audibly, then I'll be like, oh, what was that? And sometimes that'll just shut them up. I'm not trying to just shut them up. I mean, part of me might be. Part of me is like, oh, I want to keep saying what I'm saying. But if they then, sometimes they're like, I have a helpful idea for the show, you know, then right. I'll be like, oh, well, let's examine that. And then if it goes poorly, then I'll be like, well, your idea definitely didn't help the show. But right. If it goes well, then great. Then it's, you know, I don't want to encourage people to just yell out during the set. But obviously, if it happens, you know, it's part of the job to address it. Or it's part of the job to wait for the bouncer to come take them away. Right. But yeah, absolutely. Like in a place where I'm comfortable and things are enjoyable, like I will absolutely, you know, if you know that there's a group of people there who are from a certain school or studying a certain thing or are with a certain group, like, oh, maybe you'll ask them about, oh, you're here for a medical conference. Like, what is it that you're studying? What is it that you are researching? And yeah, I will absolutely be open to.
But you let yourself. Yeah. You let yourself go in that direction and not worry about the safety net of having a joke that deals with that or anything like that. And that's sort of something that you've grown into a little bit, because I find that took a while to get to that point. You know, you're so latched on to your like jokes, you know, that you're sort of like, well, this is what I know, this is what I'm going to do. But then when you kind of, I don't know if it comes out of boredom or what, but it's a nice way to break the monotony sometimes of doing just your set, you know what I mean? To kind of be able to kind of explore other things around you in the moment, you know?
And yeah. And for me, I would say also you know, I definitely am a fan of not just doing the same set over and over again. Like even if I'm, you know, headlining for a week, obviously the shape of the set might be the same every night, but there'll be some places where you can go off book a little bit or, you know, hopefully be open to things in the moment. But also like when I'm working out new stuff, like all the jokes when they're sort of in their more, you know, liquid glass form, like I don't know the exact words I'm going to say. And so I'll say them and then keep going. And if it leads to something else or if some other comedian had said something that inspires me to be like, oh, I'm going to respond to that and then go off in another direction. Like just it's always important for me to have some outlets where I can say anything and let my mind keep going. Like, and that's another like sort of freestyle rap thing, which is just keep going. Like don't stop. I mean, you can take pauses.
Are you doing the rap? Have you noticed it have an effect on your stand-up? Like, is it in any way, shape, or form? Like, has it opened up other doors for you creatively?
I guess I feel like it's more like conceptual and metaphorically connected than actively. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not all of a sudden having all of my sets also rhyme. But but that would be kind of. A secret dream that I have would be for that to happen. It would be an amazing thing to say something that is completely meaningful, and then at the end of it, have people be like, "Oh my god, that also rhymed!" Like, but right. They weren't conscious that it was. And that's the way I feel. Like Eminem is, you know, technically, I think, as far as of the rappers that I know, the best. Mm-hmm. Like at this specific thing,
why?
Where you can listen to the song "Renegade" by Jay-Z and Eminem's verses. He's just like, if you read them, I don't think you would notice that they rhymed because they were just like a real message that he's putting forth. And then you listen to it and it's like, oh my god, he's finding, or the song "Legacy" on his newest album, on the Marshall Mathers LP2, maybe my favorite song of his, or maybe of it, it's one of my favorite songs, period, in the world. Like, the whole song is in three parts, each, there's three verses, they all start that I used to be the type of kid that would, I can't even do it now, but I have the whole song memorized, but I'm in a different mind space right now. I used to be the type of kid that would always think the sky was falling. Why am I so differently wired? Am I a Martian? Is the way it starts. And the first verse is just about him being a misfit as a kid, like having a bad home life, having a tough school life, just being sad and angry. And then the second verse is where he discovers that he likes rap and is good at it. And the third verse is where he's like, oh, now I am the best at rap. And it has this arc of his whole life. It's a true story. And every rhyme in it is basically one rhyme scheme for the whole song.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, because it seems to me that you, this interest, love, passion, you tell me what the right word is, for music sort of wants to blossom a little bit, for lack of a better term, through your stand-up? I mean, in talking about this rap experience that you're having and your interest of it, it's very palpable that there's some passion there. And there's also your background in linguistics, which I know a fair amount of your stand-up, you like to sort of do material that sort of plays with the words and the form and all of that. So I kind of feel like you know, early life experiences always inform who you are until you die, frankly. So
sure.
Are you conscious of this, trying to sort of go back to your roots a little bit? I don't want to overstate it. Roots might be too heavy a word, but you know, your connection to the past as a musician, and want to consciously bring it into your stand-up or through your stand-up, or is it just coming out of you and it's just who you are?
I think it's more the latter than the former. I'm not setting out to be like, well, I started playing the violin and learning music as a language when I was four, so that's the way my life is going to shape itself. No, it's much more a discovery and sort of perpetuation of, I think that, you know, as a human, as a comedian, as a performer, as an artist, any person who identifies as any of those things, mostly everybody's got human under their belt probably, but I don't know if you have any non-human listeners, but
I do. Social media presence right now, but they're good to have.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Robots, aliens, animals, whatever, whoever's listening. I would say, like, the goal is to figure out who you are and sort of, like, the things that you like, the things that you're good at. Hopefully some of those are the same thing. And I think I've talked about this before, like, that your comedy act is sort of like, you know, you hear the thing about a sculptor, how do you sculpt an elephant? He's like, well, you take a block of marble and you chip away everything that is not an elephant or that doesn't look like an elephant, and then you have an elephant. And right. With comedy, I feel like it's the same way, but the sculpture is yourself, and you're also the sculptor. You're the person who's chipping away at parts of yourself. They're like, oh, this isn't really me. That's not me. Oh, this is me. But then in addition to chipping away, you can add things. You're like, oh, I'm going to put on some more clay over here, and we're going to make it this kind of sculpture. And it's not just, you know, now there's some glass and some wood or whatever it is. And you sort of are both editing till you get to some core version of yourself, but also adding and expanding your comfort zone and learning, you know, what better way you can be. But at the core of it, you know, like, yes, I am, like, you know, and people say to me, like, oh, your comedy is this. Your comedy is about words. And it's not necessarily, you know, like, not every joke is, not every thought that I have is. But yeah, I get where you're coming from when you say that, people who say that, because that is the way that my brain, when I hear words, when I hear sentences, I do think about.
Yeah, but but that defines you. At the end of the day, it's not about just telling jokes. It's the jokes, in my opinion, are simply a vehicle through which people understand who you are as a person and how you think. That's all they are for me, in my mind. You know,
oh, yeah.
I can see great stand-ups, and I can mention names that we both know, but I won't. And you walk away and they're funny and they're technically proficient, great setup, very tight, clever punchline, didn't see it coming, a lot of misdirection jokes, but you walk away feeling like you just had McDonald's, meaning you're hungry 5 minutes after you ate it. Like, I don't, it's an act that doesn't sit with you. It doesn't stay with you because the person, you don't really feel like you know the person after you watch it. And to me, that's a missed opportunity if you're the performer, and is almost like the obligation now as the performer, as a comic. Now, some will disagree and say it's just your job to entertain and I don't want to open myself up or whatever, but like, through that kind of thing that you do, you're owning who you are, and it defines you and frankly separates you from the rest of the pack. You know, so I think why not sort of be that? That's who you are. I mean, you have a linguistics background. I don't. I can't speak to that kind of thing the way you can, nor would I try, because it would not be real for me. But for you, it totally fits and it works and it's really funny. So it, to me, it just all makes sense that that's kind of what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that. And I mean, the thing is, everybody, every person, every comedian is different, and every audience is different. Like, there's some audiences, you know, some audiences will come out and they'll want to just be entertained. Like, you know, if they're like,
yes,
I had a rough week at work, so please
don't make me think. Yeah.
I know the world is bad. My life is bad. Please just make me laugh. Like, throw a pie in somebody's face, you know? And
right.
it's great that there are, you know, like, you know, and I mean, there's some amazing comedians who aren't political comedians as well. Like, you know, Brian Regan is one, I think everybody would agree, most people would agree, if you know about comedy, that he's one of the best. And he's not necessarily even revealing a ton about his real personal life. Like, obviously, he's showing you who he is and how he thinks and what he thinks about and what he cares about. But also even his persona of, like, dumb guy. Like, he's clearly, his brain is amazing. His brain does amazing things, creates amazing comedy. He's not just, you know, a dumb kid who didn't do well in science, but that's part of his experience and part of the way that he connects with people. And, like, you know, smart people can love him, dumb people can love him, like, old people, young people, like, so many people. Like, he has an amazing gift, but his comedy isn't even, it's not about how he has this amazing gift. He's just, he is what he is, and it's a beautiful thing. And that's, so everybody, you know, the goal, I think, ideal, I think the people that you're talking about that aren't necessarily revealing much about themselves, like, maybe they're not even, there's some people that get into comedy because they love comedy, but there's some people who want to get into singing, but they don't have as good a voice. You know, like, there's some people who can't carry a tune, and you can work on it, you can learn, you can probably get better, but there's, you know, if you start out the worst singer, you're probably not going to get to be as good as the best singer. And, you know, maybe comedy is certainly, I think, more subjective than music is. Like, you can be like, oh, are you hitting this note? Like, as opposed to in comedy, are you hitting that punchline? Like, isn't as an exact parallel. But, like, that's the thing. When an art is both there's an art and a craft to it. Like, I've heard, I think, in acting, like, there's Al Pacino is like, acting, it's an art. And, like, Harrison Ford is like, nah, it's a craft. Like, anybody can do it. There's, like, you know, there's tricks you can learn. There's things you can do. But for me, I don't audition a ton. And when I do, I don't get a ton of callbacks. Like, most of the things that I've done successfully in acting are when people were like, hey, I want you to come here and be in this because this is you. They were like, I mean, not to say that, like, I'm not even an expert in watching acting. I can tell you when somebody's amazing, and I can tell you when somebody's the worst, but I couldn't tell you anywhere in between. I'd be like, I guess that's acting. You know, that's good.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Do you have, I mean, when you're writing, obviously your material, it's sort of what you're passionate about, but then you're also thinking about, you know, like all of us, like, what's TV good and TV appropriate and getting the next set together for a TV set, and those can be a little artificial at times. You know, Bill Hicks described it as they tell you to be yourself, and then they put you in they dress you up as a woman and put you in makeup and tell you to just be yourself, and it's kind of true, and it does not lend itself to storytelling because they generally want, you know, punchlines to come pretty quickly. It's a 5-minute set. How's it? Not that you're necessarily a storyteller, but, like, let people understand, like, the process that a comedian goes through, like, to get a TV set, like, you know, you've been on Conan and what that was like, let's say, to kind of get that set together and how many times you had to submit material and over what period of time and how that kind of worked. I think people would be fascinated by that.
Sure. I think I've been fortunate in a couple ways in that I started out writing mostly one-liners, like mostly short jokes that would do well, you know, in the format of late night where they want, you know, if not a certain number of jokes or laughs per minute, just that format makes more sense to be like, oh, instead of one, obviously Bill Cosby goes on Letterman, he can do whatever he wants. And I mean, I think Kyle Kinane had a great set on Conan, and he's not a short joke guy, but, you know, enough funny things happen throughout the stories that he's telling that he's not just telling. And that's, you know, storytelling comedians aren't just like, now, once upon a time, and then 5 minutes later, there's a punchline. Obviously, people are being funny in the moments, even in between, if there are no punchlines specifically. Right. But for me personally, I remember starting out and I auditioned for a bunch of things, and, like, I was in some contests and competitions, like the Boston Comedy Festival and Seattle Comedy Competition. And, like, the style, at least, you know, not to say anything about the content, but just the style of the number of punchlines that I had, regardless of how good they were necessarily, like, I think helped me in that genre, in that format, which then sort of helped translate into late night sets where I write a lot. I mean, I think a lot, and I write things down, and I go on stage,
Do you write, like, a specific time of day for certain hours a day, or what's your process like?
I don't even sit down to write. I only, like, I don't have, the only time when I sit down is when I have my notebook and I'm transcribing it into the computer. But the way so I, yeah.
Thoughts will come to you, you write them down and kind of flesh them out over time kind of thing? Or you, like, will you write whole punchlines down and...
Usually the way it works is I have my, I used to just carry a notebook. Now I just carry a digital recorder, which I know a lot of people would be like, why don't you just use your phone? And like, I've been using a separate thing for all this time. So some of this stuff is ritual that might not even be necessary anymore, but this [S2] Right. [S1] Is the process that I go through. I am walking around during the day. I think about a thing or I have a conversation where I say a funny thing. I'm like, oh, just it, maybe it's not a full-fledged idea, but I'm like, oh, this thing could be part of a joke or part of a funny thought or an idea. And I don't edit myself or censor myself while writing at all. If I'm like, if it's about a horrible, you know, if I'm like, is this racist? Is this sexist? Like, if I'm like, I'm not going to share it with
you. Yeah, you can't do that. You get in your own way if you start doing that. You can't do that. Yeah.
So ultimately, you know, even it might be after I've tried it once or twice and be like, ooh, I don't like the way that feels or sounds or comes across. Like, that's not the message that I want to put forth. Like, even if it's funny or maybe it's not funny enough to be as, you know, I'm not saying it's like, I mean, the idea of offensiveness is subjective. But just, I want to not offend myself with my own stuff. Like, I want to say things that, if I mean it, I mean it. And if I don't mean it, then it's a silly thing. I want people to understand. I want people to know where my heart and brain and thoughts and feelings are on a thing. So that if I have a joke about pedophilia, they know that, I mean, maybe that'll make some people uncomfortable because they're like, oh, I have a situation in my life that is relevant, that, like, whatever the topic is. But I'm like, but here's what I'm saying about it. And I want it to be as logical and bulletproof and be like, look, everybody should be able to enjoy this idea, whether they are a pedophile, have been molested by a pedophile, like, have nothing to do with pedophiles, don't know any, you know. But, so I will put the idea into the recorder and then over the course of the day, you know, just do that. And then I will also record my sets at night. And then if I riff things, then I go back and listen through them the next day. And then I'll be like, oh, if I found a new idea there, then that'll go into the recorder. And then that spurs new ideas. So again, it's sort of like this positive feedback, ever-growing process where the bits get larger and larger, but they're all in the recorder. And then like after the recorder's like a certain amount of full, you know, has 100 ideas in it, I will then sit down and write those ideas into my notebook. And then through the writing process, now a different part of the brain's being activated, more time has passed, I'm in a different space emotionally, or just I'm a different person now, the cells in my body are different. I'll have different thoughts, different reactions, so then I'll add to them there. And then it's in the notebook, and then it goes, you know, keeps getting cycled and filtered through the act. And then eventually when the notebook is full, which happens maybe every 6 months, I sit down and probably over the course of a week spend 10 to 12 hours just typing everything. And again, now it's my typing brain. And then there's now some of the ideas are from 3 to 5 to 6 months ago. And I have different, I'm like, oh, I didn't even remember that. Oh, now this could go here. Now these two ideas could get connected. And like the more longer sets I do, the more likely, you know, if you're doing a 10-minute set, you won't realize that one thing from that 10-minute set might connect nicely with a thing from another 10-minute set until you're out doing an hour. So it's just constantly building up and editing down and building up and editing down. Until I'm dead, I guess.
And so people understand. So for example, when you're doing a late night set that you're getting together for like Conan, what was that process like for you in terms of like, you know, typically what you do is you get a either a video or audio set together of about 5 to 7 minutes and you submit it. Invariably, they start to either say no or part of this is right and give you notes. And then how did that process work for you?
For me, it was very fortunate that the first time I think the booker for it was the Tonight Show with Conan, and who is now the booker for Conan. He had seen me audition. I think he used to work for a comedy festival. Mm-hmm. And so he had seen me. And when he got the job, when Conan took over the Tonight Show and he got the job being the booker, he started reaching out to some people that he thought would be good to be on the show. And so I think it was right before the show was starting, or right when it was starting in like maybe June of 2009, I think I got an email from this address at NBC that I didn't actually even recognize the name. So I had a manager, and I was like, I wrote to my manager, and I was like, is this a real thing? Because it was the booker for The Tonight Show saying, can you please put together a set to submit to possibly be on the show? And he also, very nice, he's like a super nice guy, and was, I mean, for me, so great to work with, because he was like, here's some jokes that I remember that I've seen you do. Like, I mean, some of them might have been from, I'd been on Live at Gotham the year before on Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. But some of them I think he just remembered from taking notes when I auditioned for him several years earlier. And he's like, these might be good jokes too, like that would work for our show.
Is that Buck?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And he definitely, like, he encouraged me to put those down, and I said, well, I've also written a couple new things, can I put those? He's like, sure. So I made a tape of me doing, you know, some new jokes and then some of the jokes that he suggested. And like,
is this an audio tape or
I made a video. I like had a flip cam and just brought it to a lot of shows for a while. Mm-hmm. Until I got, you know, like somewhere between like probably 5 and 7 minutes, maybe 8 minutes at the time of the jokes that he wanted and the jokes that I wanted. And then he said yes to some, maybe to some, no to some. And then we just kept, you know, whittling it down until we had four and a half, five minutes of jokes that made sense. And then I put them in the order that I thought made sense. One joke needed to be reworded because you couldn't say something on TV.
How often were you sending him, how many sets and how often did you have to send that material back and forth? Was it like once a month, once every 6 months, once a week? Like how often were you going back and forth with him on that?
I think that if I remember correctly, and I could look back through my email to get it exactly, but it was certainly the whole process, but until we had the set locked in, was about no more than 2 months. Mm-hmm. So I think we must have gone back. It might have been once a week at a time. It might have been every 2 weeks. It was probably once every 1 to 2 weeks that I would send him something. Okay. And like have the updated version of like, is this what we want now? What about this? What about this? And then I think maybe he reached out to me in like May or June, and then by July we had it locked in, and then he was like, great, I'll let you know when we have an opening. And then I found out in November that I would do the show in December, and that's when I did it.
That's great. Yeah. So people, cause you know, family members say, well, it's easy to get on TV, right? Like, yeah, they don't understand even for that 5 minutes, how much work goes in, not just on the part of the act, but the show as well, because everybody wants it to be great and needs to fit the style of the show. And you find that different shows have different voices, right? I mean, so like does some of your material sit more appropriately for certain shows than others? Like, did you find Conan has a different voice than, say, the Craig Ferguson show, and vice versa?
The answer is definitely yes. They are all different. They all have different tastes and feels. I feel like, I don't know if I'm just lucky, but I haven't really thought about, like, what I would do is, like, send, you know, whatever show I wanted to get on next, I would send them, you know, either a transcript or a video or an audio file and be like, what about these jokes? And then if Conan said no to some of the jokes, then I'd be like, well, how about sending these to Ferguson? And then Ferguson would say yes to some of those jokes. And vice versa. If I, like, once, to give people an idea, though, also, like, I've definitely had some very short turnarounds. Like, I think for, like, my later Conan sets, now, like, if I send, like, hey, here's a set, what do you think about this? You're like, oh, I like this, what about replace this? And then I think the shortest time that it ever was from sending the first set to getting on was probably, like, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But then the longest time was probably about 7 years, which was for Letterman. I met, you know, when Eddie Brill was booking it, I met him in probably 2004, up in Boston. He did like a seminar or a work. He was on a panel, like at a workshop. And he talked about how he would accept tapes from anybody, and he would try to watch them all and try to get back to people. And he didn't know me, but he gave his address out to everybody. And I sent him a videotape of like a 5-minute set. And he called me, that was probably like August of 2004, maybe. And then in November of 2004, he called me. And like went joke by joke through and said, here's the jokes that I think would work for the show. But overall, he said, how long have you been doing comedy? You seem a little like, you know, green performance wise. Like you don't have the poise yet. You don't have all the confidence necessary. He's like, so that's a thing that, you know, just keep working on it and keep sending me tapes. And so I probably would send him a tape maybe every 6 months or something. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say maybe a year later, he asked me to be on a live audition at like the New York Underground Comedy Festival at the time. And like, I thought that went really well. And afterwards, he would sit down with people and be like, here again, going through. He was just very meticulous and thoughtful. And told me again which jokes he liked. And then again, he said, still, you're not ready. And then years would go and, you know, kept going by until I think 2008, I had an audition for him. And it was one of the best sets that I'd had ever up to that point. Maybe still one of the best 7-minute sets as far as like the material I was doing and the audience quantity and quality of laughter. Like I felt it was, they were so good. And that is actually a set that is on YouTube. It's the, pretty much the only stand-up set that's not a late night set that I've put on YouTube, just because at the, it was just so wonderful. And it was like, I think I did Live at Gotham that week, but, and Live at Gotham was an amazing crowd, but this crowd at the Comedy Studio for this audition for Eddie Brill was better, was just perfect. And after the set, he, you know, talked to, and he talked to me and he just said, phenomenal. And I was like, oh, wow, I got it. It's going to be great. You know, he didn't say you're on the show. This is still 2008, you know, like four or five years after the initial contact was made. And then I think I did one more audition for him like a couple months later, and he's like, ah, you're rushing again. You're not. And so I was like, oh, I'm back to not square one, but square a little further behind. And so then I kind of, not that I lost interest in being, I wanted to be on Letterman, but I was like, well, I guess this is, this process is still, I'd heard like Bill Burr, you know, took 6 years from the first time Eddie Brill saw him before he was on Letterman, that everybody has things, you know, to work on as far as not shaping yourself to be what they want, but figuring out what parts of yourself are the things that make sense to be on those shows. Like, you know, you're not going to be like Rich Voss went on Last Comic Standing and didn't swear a ton like he would in real life. If you see him at a live show, because he's like, oh, well, this is, if you want to be on this TV show, this is the way to do that. And you don't have to be on a TV show.
Yeah, every show has Piccadillo. Like Letterman sort of, you know, there's, you know, he's a little squirrely about anything, you know, any sexual innuendo, stuff like that. So every
Some like pop culture things, some don't want as many pop culture things. And so then that was 2008. So 2009 is when The Tonight Show with Conan happened. And then I remember after I was on The Tonight Show, Eddie Brill saw me and said, hey, you know, some of those, a lot of those jokes would have worked for Letterman. I'm like, well, that is good to know. And so at that point, and now it's early 2010, I was like, I'm going to start now focusing, now that he thinks I'm ready, now that he knows that I'm capable of doing a Letterman caliber late night set. I now was like, okay, well, let me now focus on the material that I think would be best. So then I think I started sending him things more often until we had, you know, in the next, I think it was another, he's like, well, now it's going to be a little while initially. In early 2010, he said, since you just did The Tonight Show, you can't do Letterman immediately. So probably 6 months later, I started sending him things like summer 2010. And then summer 2011 is when I think he said, we've got the set ready. And then October is when there was an opening. So
yeah, that's great. It was, and did you find, like with Conan, you talked about different shows have different, and just staying on Conan for a minute, since we've been talking about that, did they have a certain sort of area of topics that they liked more than others? Like, did they say, stay away from sex, stay away from religion? Were there any kind of parameters that you got from them?
When I did The Tonight Show with Conan, I remember one of the jokes that the booker liked a lot was, but that we had to adjust because of sexual content, but only for, I think, like, you know, standards and practices or something. Like, was a joke that I had where it was something about how people would be surprised that I was, you know, both good in school and also not gay. Like that, they're like, oh, I thought, like, you know, like complete sentences are coming out of his mouth, penises must go in. And right. And they were, and he was like, love it, but we can't talk about penises going into mouths on TV, on NBC. So eventually we changed it to, I think, Julian McCullough, a comedian friend who's super funny. I was like, you know, at a show with him and I'm telling him about this problem, like, how am I going to say this without talking about penises going in? And he's like, how about dudes must go in? And I was like, I guess that sounds the same, but I ran it by them. They're like, yep, that's fine. So topic-wise, it didn't matter, but content, legit.
But other than that, there were no parameters from them, huh? That was about it?
Just from them, no. Yeah, from Letterman, I remember, I had a joke that had sort of like a Simpsons reference in it, and they were like, we don't know if that one will fly here. And I was like, well, it's The Simpsons is like the most popular TV show. I'm pretty sure you might there might be some fans. But so that I had to edit out that thing. And then on Letterman, there was one really specific thing once where I had a joke about a child getting kidnapped. It was just one punchline in a joke full of a lot of different things. And they said, can you take that part out? I'm like, what? What? It was about gay people getting children. And the idea that obviously gay people aren't going out and like stealing children and, you know, kidnapping them. And they're like, can you not do that? I'm like, oh, why is it? Do you think that like, people are going to think I really think that gay people are doing this? And they're like, no, actually, like Letterman just had a thing where his child was almost kidnapped. And I was like, I can understand why they want to be sensitive there. I feel like Letterman would still understand and appreciate the joke. But I get that you're like going to be on, you know, err on the side of caution on that one. But,
yeah, absolutely. But it's interesting. Yeah, but it's interesting for people to understand that, you know, there's a lot of process here. There's a lot that comedians go through to get, you know, that we go through to get on these shows. And, you know, it's not just, hey, roll out of bed, tell a few jokes, and then they put you on TV. There's a lot of work, a lot of thought goes into it. And people should definitely check out your podcast and your Netflix special, and if you're touring, can they see you out on the road anytime soon? Where can they see you?
I mean, all my dates, usually, if I update them appropriately, should be on MikeKaplan.com, MYQKaplan.com. If this is coming out immediately, I can tell you where I'll be in the next few weeks.
Give us a couple of dates, the next 2 weeks, where you're going to be.
I'll be sort of on the Gulf Coast area, some shows in late October, some shows in the New Orleans area, Mobile, Alabama, Pensacola, Florida, and then I'll be in San Francisco for a couple dates end of October, and then in Los Angeles for a little bit, and then a big show in Atlanta on November 9th, I think. And then beyond that, I should keep having dates on the old website.
All right. Well, people can check out your site, check out your podcast, and check your Netflix special out where they can watch that one joke and go, you know, that just one more punchline there, that would have been a perfect joke. And then you can give them that new punchline on the next special.
I mean, I'll tell everybody who's listening now, the extra punchline is centaur penis. And so watch the special and see where I should have said centaur penis. Instead of man horse penis, I think. So
well, you know, a good place for centaur penis is in the mouth.
Absolutely.
So you could add that to that joke.
Horse must go in. Absolutely.
There you go. Hey Mike, this has been great. Thanks for coming on. And
thank you so much.
We'll be hanging out at the clubs and talk to you soon. All right, Mike Kaplan, everybody.
All right, that was Mike Kaplan, very funny guy. You'll see more of him. Very, 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 very hilarious man. And my tour dates on my website, as I mentioned, coming up, big dates are going to be Cap City's Comedy Club in Austin, Texas, October 29th and November 1st. Tell your friends, spread the word. November 6th through the 8th, I'm going to be at Comics Comedy Club in Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. And then I go to Omaha Funny Bone after that, then Columbus Funny Bone, Columbus, Ohio, and Denver Improv and Washington, D.C. Improv. Thanks, people. You're the best.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all.